terse and tetchy were two of the words used to describe the body language between Boris Johnson and Nicola Sturgeon when they met earlier this week. She seemed to almost shoo him into her office, which is the truth. I look back at it, and I look back at it a couple of times. But can you really all read all that much into body language and how much of it is about power play? We're joined by Louise Campbell, Robert Walters recruitment. I presume you know about these things. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon is a person of conviction, you can see, and she does a good job. And she's usually very charming and professional. She was very discombobulated.
She had a
hatchet expression.
She looked like she had reached the end of her tether. I think that Boris had bounded up the steps with his arms outstretched and was really filling the space in quite a dominant way. And then in a rather paternalistic gesture tried to shoo her into the building, and she looked like a mother who had just had enough of an irritating child, and she kind of slapped his hand down and said, "You go first." And he kind of shuffled in then. And,
so what's that about?
I think it's, I mean, if you go back to even the 2000 when you saw Arafat, and I think it was the Israeli Prime Minister, I don't know whether anyone remembers, they almost had a tussle of who goes in the door first. It's a dominance thing. You know, the person last in the door is seen to be the most powerful person.
Really?
Mm.
So if you say after you, you're the most powerful person, but if you're with a gentleman.
Yes.
And he says, no, you... After you, ladies
well, look,
first.
I mean, it's a psychological mind game, isn't it? I mean, if I was standing at a door with someone and they said, after you, I'd quite happily go in before them because, it, you know,
very
my
sensibly.
Ego isn't at a level where I would find that important.
Yeah, and you think that's what it was about?
I do. And I think that, you know, I think that Boris was being quite dominant in his approach, and he was using the typical bluster. The crowds were booing, and he wanted to be seen, and he was smiling, and he wanted to be seen to be bringing her into the building. Right. And she just said, no, you go first.
It's amazing how he did get the boos, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, because he's been just getting all the well-dones from his own side. Politicians worth noting and how they go about establishing whether or not they're the most important person in the room, or maybe they don't need to be the most important, but they need to establish a presence.
Well, I think that some politicians had a natural charisma that automatically led to them being the most important person in the room, whether that was JFK or Ronald Reagan, who was very comfortable with his public. Then you look at somebody like Obama, who I think had very, very relaxed body language, so much so that, you know, other people around him might have looked quite tense and quite formal in their suits, whereas Obama would have his shirt open. But I think, again, that's a bit of a power play within itself, because only a leader can look that relaxed while other people are looking nervously around him. Then you look at somebody, I think, like Margaret Thatcher, and I think over the years you can see how the tone of her voice changed so dramatically from being quite light and quite melodic to being very clipped, and to having an intonation that really stressed the important points when she wanted to say something.
Yeah, but she had a terribly irritating voice. Yeah. You know, I mean, she went to classes, as I know.
She did.
Because there was a kind of a whine in it.
I don't know whether she went to get rid of the whine. I think she went to try and make her voice sound more powerful, because it was a very... she had a high and low intonation in her voice, and I think she wanted to come across as being more powerful. And
on the other hand, I'd say if she came into the room, she'd dominate anyway.
I think she would.
Did you ever have dealings
with her?
She just
reminded me of when Margaret Thatcher came to Dublin Castle. There was a bit of a tussle between herself and she scared the Stang, because she started the Stang and said, I outranked this lady because I'm a head of state, she's a head of government. And we had a slight degree of waiting a certain amount of time while we kind of hosed down the two delegations and came in. And occasionally we'd have... I remember when Peter Mandelson came to Dublin and we were very displeased with him. I think there was a deliberate... time when he was left waiting in the foyer of Ivy House for a short time, just to say that we're not going to jump to your thing. So there are mind games.
That's interesting. what was the date?
I could not even tell you who the person was.
And this time was not going to have
Yeah, because of the security situation at the time, remember this is 1979, and with Margaret Thatcher, we made special arrangements to actually house Margaret Thatcher and Lord Carrington in Dublin Castle. When the French heard about this, they got very upset and demanded to know how many people have the British here in Dublin Castle, and we demand to have at least the same number, if not more. So there's sometimes games mm-hmm. played, and I think that's a reflection of the actual individuals at the top. I think Giscard d'Estaing had a kind of thing about being the most important person in Europe. Mm. And remember, France at that stage was probably the leading kind of power in
the EU.
But
you also saw, we were talking about Trump there, I mean, if you remember his famous first introduction with Justin Trudeau and the whole grabbing of the arm and all the rest.
It was comical.
But I mean, it often happens. I mean, you see it with politicians. We often observe the body language between politicians. I mean, Theresa May, when she first arrived in Dublin, with Enda Kenny.
Yeah.
She's like, there was a cold wind blowing between the two of them at that particular stage. Whereas if you would have, I seen, you know, Bertie Ahern with Tony Blair, they could practically not get off each other. They were so friendly with each other. But again, you know, I think people like Trump and Boris Johnson like to dominate, I think, the space, you know,
and body language is going to mean more, I think, when it comes to someone like Boris Johnson, because he's not straight. He doesn't have a very strong ideology. And one of the things that really struck me about the speech that he gave, his opening speech to Parliament, was, you know, he's setting himself up as an outsider campaigner. You know, he's going to end austerity. He's going to make Britain the best place to raise a child, to go to school, to start up a business. But what was really interesting about his body language was, you know, he's punching the air when he's talking about delivering Brexit. But when he was talking about ending austerity, making life better for the poorest and the neediest, his hands were in his pockets. Mm. And I think that says...
What would you say about
that? It's very telling. Well, I think, you know, when somebody is trying to make a point, and you can see it with both Trump and Boris Johnson, you know, whether it's the karate chops or the A-OK and the fist pumps and the, you know, the handshake that pulls you in, it's a level of dominance. But, I mean, it's a classic sign of, you know, when somebody is unsure of themselves or telling a lie, they've got their hands clasped in front of their chest, they've got their arms crossed, their hands are in their pockets, they start to take up less space within the room, and that's exactly, I think, what you were just talking about.
Do these things work? I mean, when I listen to Boris Johnson or Trump, I cringe. I literally cringe. I just can't take them on board at all.
I think our definition of leadership is changing, because I think if you look outside of the world of politics and look, say, at the world of tech, and you look at the likes of the Mark Zuckerbergs or the Elon Musks, these are not alpha males. They are not men who need to fill the space and punch the air and kiss babies, you know, in order to feel powerful. So I think that, you know, again, the public is probably looking for, you know, leaders of a diverse background now at this stage, and whether that be an extrovert or an introvert or a male or a female, we want diversity in our leaders.
That scary man, Mr. Cummings, doesn't need to fill the space. The headline last week was "Look at the man in the corner," and everybody was there shaking hands and doing all the proper thing, and there was a fella over in the corner in a pretty scruffy looking t-shirt. He's the man.
He's the man, absolutely.
You know, maybe, as you say, it's changing.
It's changing, and I think, you know, well, I work in the world of business, and I've been interviewing people for 25 years, and you learn to see through that. You learn to see through the, you know, the not so corporate suit or the tattoos or the piercings or whatever it is that people have, and now it's all about, can you do the job, and it being results oriented as opposed to the bluster that goes with it.
Gail?
I suppose a question for you, Louise, you know, in the case particularly of Boris Johnson, to what extent is this behaviour, you know, a true reflection of his feelings or intentions, or like much else with him, it's stage managed?
I think it is stage managed, and I think it's a, you know, he's creating a character for himself, the kind of the blustering buffoon who makes a joke of things. I don't know how long that's going to last.
He's very good at self-deprecation.
To the point, though, where everything becomes a bit of a joke. I mean, the interview with Andrew Marr there a couple of weeks ago, where I think he was asked the same question probably 10, 15 times and refused to answer it by just making a bit of a joke, that wears very thin after a while.
Well, I mean, he made his name on bumbling his way through Have I Got News For You? I mean, like, particularly he was confronted about the issues of, like, you know, Darius Guppy. This is a conflicted fraudster, a friend of his, who asked him for the number of a journalist to beat up, and he kind of bumbled his way through that, and people loved him, and he kept getting asked on this show. And that's been his shtick all the way. It was a shtick through his mayoral term in office in London. He managed to kind of almost dominate David Cameron when he was Prime Minister through this sort of buffoonery kind of. But yeah, he is Oxford educated individual. Yeah. He's not an idiot. Like,
no, he's not an idiot. And he got there on scholarships.
Yeah. Yeah.
You
yeah.
know,
yeah.
I mean, you don't get there on scholarships by being thicko. But there are all sorts of different ways of being clever.
Yeah. Mm. But, there was a brilliant documentary on, very quickly, the BBC. Michael Cockerell did a kind of a profile of Boris, and he spoke to all his siblings, and particularly Rachel, his sister.
Yeah.
He says he's calculated his moves from start to finish.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this is a guy who was wanted to be Prime Minister long before 2016. He missed out then when Michael Gove knifed him in the back or in the front. But this is where I think he's angling for a general election, because I think he wants to dominate. He wants to be, how he gets there is largely irrelevant, but that's what he wants to do.
Okay, let me come back to you on our own lot. I mean, what do you, what comments have you got on Leo and Kenny, Bertie Ahern, all of the...
Which one? I think that Leo is... has got charisma. I think he's well respected. I think you can see that when he is with his European counterparts, that there is a level of respect there. I wouldn't necessarily say he's the most charismatic leader that the country has ever seen, but I think that he has a level of competence that comes through and leads to a level of respect. I think somebody like Enda Kenny was probably a very different leader, in the sense that he was much more serious. I don't think he sought potentially the public's adoration, but he had an authenticity to him and to that level of seriousness that I think commanded a certain level of respect.
Well, he was very user-friendly with people. He had the common touch, possibly in a way that Leo doesn't.
Definitely doesn't. I mean, if you see the two of them, how they would enter a room, Enda would be fist pumping with the kids and high five and really cheesy, like the stuff that would drive you, like you kind of go, oh God, he's at this again. Whereas, like Leo Varadkar's problem is he'll go into a room where he should be pressing the flesh with people, and he'll stand there talking to his advisors.
Yeah.
And be, now he's shy. He's a shy individual.
Yeah, no, that's not a crime.
No, it's not. But it does go to show the contrast. You know, even, you know, at Fine Gael party events, there you often hear complaints as, why is the Taoiseach holed up in his room when he should be walking the lobbies and the bars and pressing the flesh? And he doesn't do that.
You must have seen some of them. Bertie Ahern was just a flippin' master at working a room.
He was.
Mm. I used to, well, not that I was there that often, but I saw him at a number of things that were kind of charitable things. Mother of the divine, you would get around every single solitary person in the room. You must
absolutely
have...
Absolutely, and himself and Blair were unbelievable. You'd be walking through Stormont and Blair would turn around to somebody who was cleaning the windows and say, Mary, how's the sun doing? In the... And it was unbelievable, and it wasn't made up. But on Leo, I have some dealings with him, and it's hard to get the start, but once he gets to know people, he's actually very warm.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why he's so popular with the leaders in Europe, that once you get past the stage of sort of informal, he's not a hail fellow well met, but once he gets into that, I think he's a very warm personality from what I saw of him. But Bertie was in Ecton zone, and Bertie was one of these people who took the view is, those that mind don't matter, and those that matter don't mind. So you just do what you do. Go in there and don't care what...
Bertie also used to have three stock phrases. How are the hard-working lads? How's it going? Colin McCarthy used to tell me a great story, that, you know, over 10 years, you know, anything could have been going on with the economy, but Bertie would only say, how are the Dubs are doing, or how do you think the Dubs are doing? There you go. Like, so there are three or four lines.
I think we'd call that diversionary tactics.
Skill Maybe. Within itself.
Yeah. Now, belittling others. There are ways that people go about belittling
Absolutely,
others.
Yeah. And again, whether or not it's from a physical point of view, whether it's the handshake, whether it's pulling people in, whether it's walking down a corridor and expecting everybody to get out of your way, whether it's talking over people, you know, or whether it's that the smirk. And I think, you know, Trump, he finds it very difficult to hold his facial expression without smirking or snarling at people. You know, and all of those things go around and make up the you know, belittling others when you're in conversation with them.
Right, well, let everybody bear all of that in mind. Just before I go to my break, since you mentioned the economy, I had it on my list of things and I didn't get it to it earlier, Jim Barr. Our new central bank man.
Yeah.
And Draghi getting involved. and saying he's not appropriate. What do you make of that?
Well,
and the two former central bank people.
Yeah, I mean, they, technically speaking, the European Central Bank cannot tell a national central bank or a national government who they appoint as head of their central bank, but they can actually contribute. And Draghi certainly expressed some reservations about that appointment. And those,
will you remind our listeners who the man is and why there's a question mark?
Just what's his name? Mailoff, M-A-H-L-O-U-F, OK? He was in the New Zealand Treasury and the part of the budget was leaked, something that Phil Hogan will, I suppose, remember fondly in a different context. But part of the budget was leaked and he put out a statement that it was hacked. But it actually turned out that it was put up on the department's website. So he tried to cover it up and I think the official word at the time was, after the investigation, that he acted inappropriately or something like that.
Pretty strong language, though.
Like. Pretty strong language, absolutely. I mean, I have to say, maybe it's my ignorance, but when he was appointed, I had to Google to see who he was. I had no idea, okay?
Right. Yeah.
It was totally a bolt out of the blue. The word on the street was Sharon Donnery was a shoo-in for the job. And based on what I know of Sharon Donnery, she would have been a very good appointment.
Yeah, it's very unusual,
very unusual,
I gather,
yes,
for two former governors to object to the current appointment.
It is, and some of the arguments being made was that he's not an economist. But there was a time here before Patrick Honohan, when it was the former Sec-Gen of the Department of Finance who got the job.
Yeah.
You know, people like Maurice O'Connell.
That's right.
So they weren't economists. Okay, so I think that's a rubbish argument. I suppose the biggest issue here, I mean, being head of the Central Bank of Ireland isn't exactly an important position, because since the European Central Bank took control of monetary policy, the decisions are made in Frankfurt.
But they have a regulatory role.
And in fact,
role.
They have. That's where the role stands in. And I can't comment on Mailoff. I just don't know. But Sharon Donnery, I think, would have been a very strong candidate in terms of running the regulator.
Are notoriously snobbish people, like, and the politics of the European Central Bank.
We have a snob sitting here.
The European the European Central Bank is notoriously snobbish.
It is,
and they have looked down their noses at this guy repeatedly. So whereas Philip Lane, who is a brilliant academic, and Patrick Honan were more than capable of holding their own at European level. I mean, I was getting kind of calls from people in Europe saying, who is this guy? Do you know anything about him?
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of, like, people are sniffy about him. Like, so I'm not surprised at the stories that, you know, concerns have been expressed, particularly in light of what has come out of New Zealand. But, like, what has been very, very clear politically is, you know, there have been all these sort of calls for him to be the process to be paused. He's been already been appointed by the president. He is the central bank governor. There is no way of undoing this.
I think a more interesting perspective for Ireland now is that the most important and influential economic brain in Europe is now Philip Lane. So that is really important from an Irish perspective.
Ray?
Well, I say, you know, there's a suspicion that, you know, like judges, like the legal profession, people don't like outsiders coming in, and there's a kind of a club. After the collapse, the economic collapse, there was a big push for all the embassies to identify people in the diaspora who could take up, you know, positions on state boards and various things like that. And all the embassies prepared all our big lists, and of course none were appointed because it got back to government buildings and somebody had to do such and such. I think it's a good appointment because it's outside the club. And, you know, an important position would be a vote on the board of the
East.
And remember, Christine Lagarde is not an economist, she's a lawyer.
But she's surrounded by economists.
Yes.
Like, they've hot and cold running economists IMF.
I think it's slightly, we don't like people from the outside coming in. Mm. All these people have been schooled in the same kind of thought process and everything like that. You bring a person in from New Zealand, it's the other end of the world. They're going to bring in new ideas, and God knows they may even question some of the fundamentals.
Yeah, well,
perish the
thought. An interesting part in his background was that he was one of the IMF people who was talking about Ireland's corporate tax situation some years ago.
Yeah.
So that will be an interesting perspective.
He better watch his step there.
I have to say, personally, I think we'll just judge the job he does. Yeah. You know,
He's going to have to deal with the New Zealand situation and actually be very open about what actually happened and climb climb down on it.
But apparently he wasn't open.
No, he wasn't. That's the problem.
That was the problem.
But now he's going to have to speak to us, I think.
To the committee.
Yeah, that he's going to have to speak.
You think so?
Oh, he is, yeah.
The T-shirt and Pascal Dunne have made clear that, you know, as a way of trying to assuage people, he will have to give a public statement before he takes up his role. So that's expected.
You said he has his role. He is it.
Yeah, but he's not due to take up until September.
All right.
But he will due to address those concerns before he does that, is what we're told.
What advice would you give to him as he goes before that committee? Last question.
Well, regarding his body language, I would tell him to stand up straight, not cross his arms over his chest, not put his hands in his pockets, to speak nice and slowly and clearly. And
Answer the questions.
There's a good ideally.
Idea.
Yes.
Answer the questions. Right. They're the good ones. Listen, thank you very, very much indeed. That's Louise Campbell, MD of Robert Walters Recruitment. And we take a break.